Professors FM.
Doug, as you know, we have joined the Professors FM podcast network. So it's extremely exciting. It's like, for the first time in my life, I'm going to have academic friends. This is big. And as part of this, we're going to talk about some of the other shows on the network. One of the things we talk a lot about in terms of sports analytics is the role of incentives, right? It's all about incentives. And so one of the other shows on the network is called Taxes for the Masses, brought to you by Lisa DeSimone from the University of Texas and Bridget Stomberg from Indiana University. And so what these two ladies do is they dive into all things taxes. I think it's a great compliment to what we do. In some ways, there's nothing bigger in public policy than taxes in terms of shaping the economy and society, because taxes change how people behave. So, you know, give it a listen. Great show.
Analytics with Mike Lewis, the podcast where we talk about everything you need to know about sports analytics. Here's your host, Mike Lewis, marketing professor at Emory University.
Hey, welcome everyone. Welcome to the Fanalytics podcast. Mike Lewis, Doug Battle, brought to you by the Emory Marketing Analytics Center. Doug, we continue to move through the NBA playoffs, the most interesting, I don't know if it's the best, but the most interesting NBA playoffs that I can remember in terms of dynamic, evolving storylines. And so where do you want to start?
Mike, let me just start off by saying, this is the first time I can remember where the NBA Finals was up for grabs for anyone. I mean, it truly feels like a democratic process in that sense. And by that, I mean, typically right now we know, okay, you know, the Lakers are playing some small market team in the Western Conference Finals, and a team like the Nets in the Eastern Conference Finals is playing, you know, similar, like a team like the Hawks, and you kind of know where things are going. It's going to be Nets-Lakers, but all of a sudden it's like the NBA is not rigged, and that's becoming clear to the most casual of fans. And so I think it's exciting as someone who just pulls for chaos a lot of times in sports, and seeing the dream of a Hawks Suns finals is still alive. I actually think it's plausible. Like, I really do think the Hawks are a pretty good matchup for the Milwaukee Bucks, or I should say that the other way around. And then on the flip side, I think the Suns are the better team. We'll see. I know the Clippers like to start off 0-2, so, and they still have yet to have Kawhi for this series, so we'll see what happens. But the fact that the Clippers are like the big market team that's left just kind of shows what a crazy year it is.
It will be interesting to see how the information I've seen on TV ratings so far has said that they're up relative to 2019. They're way up relative to 2020.
Okay, of course.
Marginally relative to 2019, but that was largely based on the first round. As we were talking, I pulled up the odds for winning the finals. The Bucks are the favorite. The Suns second. Clips third. Clippers and Hawks are actually a little bit sort of decisive underdogs at this point. Yeah, it's a good question. Based on what we've seen so far, I don't know how you actually rule the Hawks out, given what they've already overcome. I agree with you. Usually in the NBA, it seems like we know that we're going to have the Warriors, or we're going to have LeBron, or back in the day, we're going to have Magic or Larry or Michael. This one could be any of these matchups at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the conference finals. There's no LeBron. There's no Steph Curry. There's no Lakers. There's no Heat. There's none of these teams we're so used to seeing. There's no Celtics. Honestly, for the league, probably not the best case scenario. I can't imagine viewership. I know it's going to be better than last year because of COVID. And I've already seen some articles like, you know, NBA numbers are skyrocketing relative to last year. Like, well, of course, last year was horrible and there were no fans. It was so weird. But now, you know, I can't imagine relative to a normal year that this is a great situation for the NBA. Like Durant versus LeBron, I think is like the best
Durant
case scenario.
Durant versus LeBron and New York versus Los Angeles as the favorites going into this. Now, Milwaukee versus Atlanta. Phoenix versus Atlanta potentially.
Phoenix versus Milwaukee. Either way, it doesn't look ideal for the NBA, but for me, it's great because it's like you feel like this gives hope. You know, we talk about hope all the time. This gives hope to those smaller market teams, those teams that aren't historically always in the finals and always loaded. I feel like the Hawks, I was thinking about this yesterday after their big win, that might be a sleeping giant of a basketball franchise. You've seen that fan base come alive in recent weeks, as any fan base would with this kind of playoff success. But Atlanta, like we talk about Atlanta like it's Milwaukee. Atlanta's not Milwaukee like that. We talk about them like they're this tiny market. Atlanta's a pretty big market, and it's got a sports hungry, championship starved fan base built in largely through the Braves and the Georgia Bulldogs and a little bit Falcons as well. And of course, the Atlanta United. And so, who are less championship starved, but you know, I was thinking about it. And I was like, man, that is kind of the perfect city to be a basketball city, and they just haven't been because they haven't had success. But now they got this team that's very young, seems to be well positioned as far as cap space, as far as you know, draft picks, all the rest for the future. And they have a chance to make the NBA Finals. Yeah, we talked a couple weeks back about this feeling like the Golden State Warriors years back when it was the early days, when they weren't winning finals, but it kind of felt like they were going to be around for a while. Trae Young seems to love the city, love that franchise, and I wouldn't be surprised to see the Atlanta Hawks stay in the conversation for years to come, which I don't remember the last time we could say that.
Well, let's talk about Atlanta for a second as a market. Atlanta is, Atlanta has, we talk a lot about brands and team brands. Atlanta as a brand is an interesting one. Always the major city in the South, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Florida cities don't count as part of the South.
Well, yeah, that's the Northeast.
Atlanta, all right, the transfer from the Northeast. So Atlanta, and I think Atlanta's coming of age was really the 96 Olympics, and the city has grown tremendously since then. I think the Atlanta metro area is probably in the neighborhood of about 6 million, so that's right along the lines of, let's call it sort of just the second tier of cities, of Dallas, Boston, Houston, just outside of the New York, Chicago's, and L.A.'s. Atlanta has long wanted to really make themselves something of an entertainment capital. Atlanta has invested heavily in subsidies for the movie industry. I think Atlanta might be number two or number three in terms of film industry expenditures in the U.S. And what people don't know is I think Georgia also has subsidies and incentives in place for things like video games and other aspects of the entertainment industry. Atlanta also, sorry, I keep going back and forth between Atlanta and Georgia. And frankly, they're very different places,
That's fair.
That Georgia and Atlanta have also invested very heavily in sports over the last few years. Mm-hmm. Everyone's playing in a new or a refurbished arena. I think folks would argue that the Falcons had the most dynamic, advanced stadium. It's probably number three or four now with the new ones coming online, since it's always an arms race.
Yeah.
But what does Atlanta not have? Atlanta doesn't have the history.
History, yeah. I was thinking about that. Like, I've been to a game at Phillips Arena. I've been to a game at Staples Center. Staples Center, outside the arena, there are statues of everyone. Shaquille O'Neal is probably my favorite statue there, but Magic Johnson. There's probably 20 statues of basketball legends, Hall of Fame caliber players that have been a part of that franchise. And the Atlanta Hawks, you got Dominique Wilkins out there. And I don't know a single person that watched the Hawks when Dominique Wilkins played. It's kind of like the NBA demographic. As far as viewership now, the age of people that watch the NBA, like, they hardly know who Dominique Wilkins is. And so that kind of tells you what you need to know about the Hawks history.
But let's stay there for a second, because that's something that we've been talking a bit about for a while now. This kind of the strange notion of, and I don't really fully know how to articulate this, but the NBA has long chosen this kind of cultural approach to building fan bases, this superstar approach, this almost integration with pop culture and hip hop. Mm-hmm. And it does make me wonder if that has consequences in terms of fan retention. So when you say you don't know folks that watched the Hawks or currently still watch the Hawks that were fans of Dominique, I remember Dominique Wilkins, the human highlight film.
Yeah.
Really, a Michael Jordan level athlete. Mm-hmm. Maybe not a Michael Jordan level basketball player, but clearly the same level of athletic ability. Truly,
right.
Truly spectacular. And I remember the Hawks back in the day, and memory is always fuzzy at this point, that the Hawks were a competitive team with a very legitimate top five superstar. But how much of that fan base has been retained from the mid-'80s? And they're still all in. I suspect you're right that the NBA is it's sort of like Pepsi in the cola world, right? Mm-hmm. They're always emphasizing the youth market. The NBA is always trying to get the new fans. My kids are big fans of the NBA more so than the other sports. So the NBA wins some with their strategy, but they also probably, I think you're right, they lose something. They don't retain the 50s and 60-year-olds.
Yeah, it's not that
as,
same
as a group.
That same retention. Like, MLB is a great example of, they do a good job of retaining. I mean, those fans are fans for life. I think the NFL's become more that way as well. People kind of stick with the team that they, I mean, even me, I grew up pulling for the New York Giants, randomly selected them as my team as a child. And they have totally different players now and totally different, I don't know, it's a different coaching, different front office, all the rest, but I still feel like that's my team. I feel like I'll never be able to pull for another team. With the NBA, I grew up pulling for the New Jersey Nets, and now they're the Brooklyn Nets, and I could care less about them. So I don't know. Another thing with the Hawks is that they've changed their aesthetic so many times. We talked about this in our Jersey episode earlier in the year. They've changed their look, and they and even now they have kind of a gold and black branding versus a red and black and yellow branding. And historically, I guess red and yellow is the most consistent they've had, but they've been red and blue. They've been blue and green. I mean, they are a totally different looking team, different logos over the years. And so it feels like a new franchise. Like this year they're wearing new uniforms, and it feels like this is a new basketball franchise that just moved to Atlanta. And they're doing pretty well. I would probably stick with the current branding and for as long as I can, if I were them.
The aesthetic issue is well taken. And I think it's completely on point with what we're talking about.
Yeah.
If you are going for this youth culture, then you're playing essentially a fashion game.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're then chasing it. So you're trying to come up with a new design. It's it's Oregon football, right? Where it's like, when you're not a legacy, you're not USC or Notre Dame or Alabama, you put out you try and do stuff to be interesting, right? And I think that's what the Hawks have done. It's continually change the uniforms. I know at times the Hawks have done really well in terms of merchandise sales. Mm-hmm. I suspect at other times they've done they've done relatively poorly. When we did that, and look, when we did that episode on the uniforms, those were primarily your ratings. I was just sort of, I'm just kind of chipping in, and I enjoy doing it. But I was struck by as we went through them, and as we were ticking down, and we got to the Celtics, after looking at all this new stuff, it was like, oh my God, the classics just work.
Yeah, they do.
Right? And I suspect that's true across, you know, we go any league, and it's like you would love the ones that don't change. And so that is a, you know, that's a tough one for sports franchises, that kind of consistency, because, you know, and I'm probably going on too much here, but, you know, as a marketer, you can always imagine that the marketer has this kind of task, right? And we're not even talking about sports for a moment, that you're kind of chasing sort of excitement in the short term, and you're trying to build the brand in the long term. What's the easiest way to create some excitement? Like change the package, right? Put a new color on it. And yeah, you probably get some pop. Maybe you get some pop and your quarterly sales go up. You sell some more jerseys that year, but long term, you don't build anything. Mm-hmm. Coca-Cola can, very similar, right?
Yeah. So real quick, Mike, the Sixers are out. The Hawks just eliminated them. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the process and what that has yielded for this Philadelphia franchise in recent years. Years of tanking, years of building through the draft, and really nothing to show for it. I saw a tweet where the Atlanta Hawks have been to the Eastern Conference Finals, completely rebuilt from scratch, totally different players, and made it back to the Eastern Conference Finals sooner than Philadelphia has made it with their approach.
Yeah, that seems to be the thing, that the process has concluded and it is a, I don't know if you want to call it a failure, right? But it wasn't successful. If the only goal is to win championships, I feel bad for Simmons. He's really taking a beating as a basketball player who's a
what happens when you're the number one player, that number one pick, and you can't shoot. That's always been amazing to me. And Philly was the team multiple years that positioned themselves well and drafted a player that could not shoot a basketball with the number one pick. We saw it with Ben Simmons. We saw it with Markelle Fultz. And if you look back in retrospect, like the Celtics those years had the number three pick and came away with Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. Both are all-star caliber players. Imagine if the Sixers had drafted those players alongside Joel Embiid. You know, they'd easily be the best team in the NBA. So I feel like the process, as much hate as it gets, I actually think it kind of worked as far as positioning them for success. I just think they drafted the wrong guys.
Well, but that's always a tough one, right? Draft it. And so I think this is a good kind of interesting question for the analytics folks out there. Is, and I suspect that analytics have very little to do with drafting in the first round of the NBA, of drafting within the lottery. That, you know, some, let's say, you know, the pointy-headed analyst wearing with his thick glasses comes in and goes, you know, I've run some analyses and we should take this player, not the player you're leaning to. I don't think it's ever going to matter. I think general managers have, and look, I think from a statistical sense, in terms of the predictive ability of models versus human insight and watching these guys and sort of genuine basketball experts, the models should be informative. But this version of the NBA playoffs does leave me wondering, you know, what does it take to actually get that high-end talent, sort of this boom-level talent? Because, Doug, and you might have a better sense of this than I do, but I think a lot of the stars were drafted outside of, let's say, the very elite picks.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
That you guys, I want to say Luka and Trey were like 4 and 5.
That's as high as it gets.
Mitchell, Devin Booker.
Those guys are further back, yeah.
Some of these guys may have been in the teens. And so what is it that identifies that? And look, you're going to miss a lot more at that point, but what is it? Is there anything that helps you predict where you're, because look, I mean, if the game is about getting superstars, then you want to roll the dice. You want to have as much upside as possible. I don't know the answer to it, but look, part of me wonders, and you tell me what your thoughts are on this too, Doug, that if you're drafting at the top of the draft, it's almost like you got some handcuffs on you at this point.
You do. And
right? You got to take one, or, you know, this guy, right? You got to take Zion.
Well, it's always like that. I remember with Philly and Markelle Fultz, I remember the Celtics had the number one pick. And I, at the time, when Brad Stevens went to Boston, I really started following that team and rooting for them. And I did not like Markelle Fultz as a prospect. I thought, you know, my thinking with these number one picks and having a guard is, in today's NBA, you do not pick a guard with that big of an asset thinking we can teach him how to shoot a basketball. It's not like this kid just started playing back. These kids play AAU year round for years and years. I mean, I played basketball. You know, if you're in high school and you can't shoot a basketball by then, you're not a shooter. You can't shoot. Ben Simmons, who is a little bit of a different story, but Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz both could not shoot, and everyone knew it coming into the NBA. Their free throw percentages were horrible, and they were number one picks to Philadelphia. Meanwhile, Boston traded back and took who I thought was the best player in the draft, and Jason Tatum. Celtics fans were pissed about it because Jason Tatum, you know, all year round, you heard Markelle Fultz is going to be number one. Markelle Fultz is the best player in this draft. Markelle Fultz, if you actually looked at the players, you know, I think if you took the hype, put the hype aside and put the perception, the unanimous perception of these guys aside and just looked at the individual players, Jason Tatum to me was far superior. I saw him play in person, so I may have been biased. But Markelle Fultz was a small guard who couldn't shoot a basketball. And, you know, Boston traded back, got more assets, and got, you know, their future star. I think Philly may have bought into the hype with those number one picks, but, you know, Ben Simmons being another one, Ben Simmons to me is a tremendous talent who I think can, if utilized correctly, can be a very good player in the NBA. Great defensive player, great passer, great. To me, he's like Draymond Green if he were a much better athlete. Draymond Green's been an all-star. So, I think Ben Simmons, was a tough one. It'd be tough not to pick him if you're in that position. But all that to say, you know, talking about don't know what makes one player better than the next. You look at these guys we talked about, regardless of where they were picked. Devin Booker was a tremendous shooter in college. Trae Young was lights out. I mean, we already had the Steph Curry comparisons in college. And so, you know, if you look at today's NBA, you look at the top players, the top guards, it's shooters. It's guys that are shooting on the perimeter. And, I kind of think Devin Booker, I remember when the Jazz had the opportunity to take him and thinking, man, they're going to be well positioned to compete for a while if they take this guy. And they took Trey Lyles, who's, you know, I guess kind of a utility power forward who's jumped around in the league. I think he played for the Spurs last time I checked. And thinking, you know, why are they doing this? They need a shooter, and Devin Booker's right there. And like, yeah, he didn't start very much in college, but it doesn't matter. You look at him as a shooter, and we've seen that even with some of these Tyler Hero and the Heat's other guy, Duncan Robinson, who went undrafted and is a 3-point marksman. I mean, in today's NBA, if you can hit a lot of threes at a high percentage, you're going to be valuable. You're at least going to be a solid role player, and at best, you're going to be an all-star. We've seen with Devin Booker and Trae Young and some of these young budding stars in the NBA that that's the case. On the flip side, some of the great athletes who can't shoot to save their life, those type of guys are I guess, may have been more valuable in yesterday's NBA, where it was a lot more drive to the paint and score. But it's so 3-point driven now that those guys are less and less valuable. And in my opinion, you know, that can be the difference. And I think it has been for Philadelphia.
Well, it's an interesting discussion. And I think part of the thing that I struggle with in terms of, let's say, the analytics, because like the analytics of drafting players, you know, I love that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I've done some work in soccer. I've actually done some work in drafting in the WNBA of all places. And it's, let me also add something to, you know, I was watching ESPN this morning and Magic Johnson was on and they were talking about Simmons, and Magic was saying that what he would do is he would take Simmons to the gym every day this summer. He'd be in the gym with him every day. They'd play one-on-one. They'd take a lot of shots. And Magic Johnson clearly believes, and look, you and I are both big fans of optimism and the idea of believing. And so Magic Johnson clearly believes that he can fix that kind of deficiency. Okay. Now you just said that it seems like the guys, and look, I'm with you. It seems like the kids that could shoot a basketball in sixth grade were the ones that could still shoot in, you know, high school and in college.
I'm,
right?
I'm just wondering, like, what player could not shoot before the NBA and became a great shooter at that point in their career? I can't think
of
a single one.
What player could not shoot in high school and became a great shooter in college?
Yeah.
I mean, there's something to that. And so does Magic Johnson have a basketball PhD, but also may have some biases in terms of thinking that he or his selected coach can actually fix problems that maybe they can't, right? A little bit of overconfidence. I think your observation that identifying kind of the key shooters would serve people well in terms of drafting as an outsider. Look, all of us are outsiders unless we're working in an NBA front office. I think the challenge might be into actually figuring out who the truly special shooters were, right? Figure out what it is. And look, this can be microseconds in terms of releases. It could be release points. It could be distance in terms of defender closing. There could be a lot of micro data that we're just not going to have access to.
Mm-hmm.
But I suspect you're right that that's where the analytics of drafting should go, to really kind of figuring out those really kind of issues on the edges that end up having someone translate to, you know, a Booker or a Trae Young at the next level, and where some great college shooters do not make that, you know, what's the difference between, and again, you know what, I'm not even going to go there, but it seems like there are some great college shooters that often play for places like Duke that don't transition beautifully to the next level, and other guys that do.
Yeah.
And I think that's really tough data to find.
Yeah. Another interesting aspect of the Sixers and the players they drafted is, with those number one picks, they drafted top prospects who were not able to lead their team even into the NCAA tournament. Ben Simmons and LSU, they were a horrible team. They did not win very many games. Markelle Fultz at Washington, very bad team, put up a lot of stats. I remember Jason Tatum's stats were not as impressive in going and seeing him play and realizing this guy is way underutilized at Duke. They pretty much had him playing power forward, but just about any time he actually got in a one-on-one ISO situation, he scored the basketball. And feeling like you put that same kid over at LSU or over at Washington and he's scoring 30 points every night. I can go both ways on this. I think, like, for example, I think the whole winner thing with quarterbacks, I think quarterbacks can be judged unfairly because they play on a good team, because they're surrounded by great talent and a great coach. But at the same time, in basketball, a five-man sport, when you've got a player that's supposed to be the number one player in a draft and he's unable to carry a college team, to me, that raises some concerns. And I think, you know, in retrospect, we're seeing that with Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz, like some intangibles, mental toughness that we've seen a lack of, that's really affected Ben Simmons this postseason.
Yeah, it's a good discussion. And I think that's kind of clear. Look, the key to winning is probably drafting and identifying the right free agents. Right free agents are probably more of a financial management kind of process for success. But this discussion highlights truly the complexity of analytics. And look, I know there's been a lot of growth in terms of NBA franchises investing in analytics. Often I suspect that they don't quite get it right, that a lot of times analytics has ended up being kind of the pure quant person that doesn't truly seem to understand sort of the way the model should work with the individual decision makers, the basketball experts. Because everything you're naming, right? This idea that, you know, it's become more and more of a shooting league, the stats bear that out, right? There's more three-point shots taken almost every year. I don't know if this year continued the trend or not.
Sure it did.
Shooting has become more important. This observation about leadership, everyone that's ever played a sport knows that it's not purely about physical talent, that the people on the floor with you or on the field with you, the character of those people matter, right? Observing character and putting that into an analytical model, you know, good luck with that. It's not going to be effective. So it really is. And then look, we add things like Magic Johnson to this equation of thinking that he can fix maybe a flaw that he can't, right? It's like all this stuff has to come together. The data, the real world insights in terms of, well, let's have the leadership reflected by winning, but let's also use the data to correct for our biases. It's a really tough problem. I kind of doubt that any frankly, I'm going to, you know, this is going to be kind of the arrogant academic, but I doubt that there are very few organizations that are actually sort of taking the right big picture perspective in terms of putting that stuff together.
Yeah.
Which is fair, look, because at the end of the day, any kind of high, look, in academia, high level decision making, we're hiring a new dean. How are we going to do that? And in fact, I work at a place that's hiring a new dean. Is anyone gathering any data? Are people looking at the data that predicts which deans are going to be the best fundraisers out there?
Doubt that.
Absolutely not. It reverts completely back to, well, you know, they're coming from a place like Harvard or Wharton, so that's a nice pedigree, and I like the look in their eye.
Yeah, kind of. One last comment on the Sixers. I saw a tweet the other day after they lost, and it said, is Philadelphia the new Atlanta? Does Philadelphia have the Atlanta sports curse? And first off, no, they're not. Clearly, the Philadelphia Eagles won a Super Bowl like 4 years ago. I'm not sure if that's the right. Pretty recently. But to be fair, this is an interesting fact here. The Philadelphia sports teams have had four number one picks since 2015 across the board. Four number one picks, number one overall in the draft. And they ended up with Carson Wentz, Ben Simmons, Markelle Fultz, and Mickey Moniak. So
is that a hockey player or a baseball player?
That's the question. But the fact that that's the question is telling. It's telling. Carson Wentz, you know, I actually thought wasn't a bust for quite a while until he was.
Well, you know, the other difference between Philadelphia and Atlanta is the word transplants.
Yeah.
Right. So the fan bases also have a different. Well, you know, there's probably two key differences in terms of the fan bases. Number one, transplants. Philadelphia fans sort of, you imagine most of those fan bases are sort of born and raised in that area, and they're just going to root for the Eagles or the Sixers. They're also going to hate on those teams, but you know, they've got that level of that love hate kind of passion that's, you know, maybe more transient in Atlanta, where a lot of folks have moved in. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we can never forget about is that Atlanta pro sports has this big, I mean, and look, you're not going to like this language, Doug, but Atlanta pro sports has this big problem that there's this behemoth of a program in Athens, Georgia, in the suburbs, essentially, that is the first love of, I don't know, 50% of everyone that lives in the Atlanta metro area. Yep. Maybe that's too high. But in Philadelphia, right, they're, you know, that's never going to exist. No one's really concerned about going down and rooting for Villanova or Temple or whatever.
Right, and that 50% might be too high. But at the same time, I know, you know, you talked earlier about Atlanta kind of being the city in the Southeast. Everyone I know in Atlanta either went to Georgia, Alabama, Auburn, LSU, SEC schools, right? And so there is that first love of college football, of these football schools. And it's odd. It's especially odd to people who aren't from the Southeast. But in the Southeast, college sports are professional sports. And professional sports are like minor league sports. And so the Hawks have, as far as the fan passion and the feeling of significance of victory, it doesn't mean as much to people, the Hawks and the NBA and the Falcons. It's like the local minor league team lost a championship. You know, it's a bummer. But what really matters is what happens in the fall, and, you know, between the hedges or on the plains in Auburn or, you know, Bryant Denny Stadium in Alabama. That obviously is not the case. I mean, I think the Philadelphia Eagles run Philadelphia. That is the team and the Sixers of basketball, and I mean, it goes across the board.
I can relate to this, right? Because as an Illinois guy, the University of Illinois gets a little bit of coverage. It's similar, right? Chicago is a Bears, Bulls, Cubs, Blackhawks town. The Illini are irrelevant unless they are great, and then they get a little bit of kind of bandwagon fandom. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways it's the South. Look, the Northeast is like that as well, right? Where, you know, the Big Ten went out and they want to get Rutgers to get the New York market. I doubt that the New York market cares so much about Rutgers. But, you know, that we have these markets that are really driven by the pros. Then you come down south, Georgia, Florida. I just name those since they have pro teams and college teams. And the balance shifts. You know, Florida might be more about the Gators, Georgia about the Bulldogs. It's just, what, you know, the history is what matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Georgia football or Alabama football could have a 500 year, which it's hard to imagine right now for either of those teams. But it's happened. And we'll sell out just about every game. Atlanta Hawks basketball. I feel like these are some of the first sellout crowds I've ever seen in Phillips Arena. I mean, regular season games are certainly nowhere near capacity. And it is the opposite of what you're saying, where it's like there is that bandwagon fandom when they're really, really good. Most of the time, not so much.
Yeah. Well, so the NBA playoffs continue. It's going to get even more interesting, right? Because like one of the continuing things has been kind of the changing of the guard. So going forward, is this Giannis's turn? Mm-hmm. Does Trae Young make a trip to the finals?
Is Trae Young the new Steph? Is he going to be that guy? Yeah.
Is he the new Steph? Is Kawhi Leonard the, you know, is he continuing to battle for supremacy in LA? Is it the Chris Paul show? So a lot of good stuff still to come. The other thing I want to talk about this week, Doug, and actually I also want to circle around to the Supreme Court decision related to college athletes, sort of adjacent to NIL stuff. But last week saw a bunch of stories that I think really showed how sports, politics, marketing, and culture are all completely wrapped together. And I think, I suspect it's kind of a disaster in waiting for just about everyone. That in a way, it's going to be the end of the mass market, and we're going to move towards sort of more fractured markets for sports, for brands, and for leagues. So story number one, the NFL announced rules for unvaccinated players. The rules, which were agreed to by the NFL and the NFLPA, outlined that unvaccinated players would still be required to get tested every day. They would have to wear masks in the facility, face travel restrictions, and generally remain isolated from teammates and staffs. I'm going to guess that vaccination rate for, I'm just going to throw this out there, based on some background information, maybe 50% of the players have been vaccinated.
Yeah.
So are we going to, is this sustainable, or is this a system that's going to break? And if it works, are the players going to, essentially, the players that do not want to be vaccinated, are they going to feel forced into this?
Yes. I know Cole Beasley has already come out and been very outspoken against this and has threatened retirement and all the rest. I don't know what, you know, there comes a point where it's like, okay, are they going to do this with the flu vaccine too? And other vaccinations or I don't know. I mean, there's another aspect of it. You don't know the health history of any of these guys and their reasoning for why and why, you know, why they would or wouldn't. But my understanding is it's not forced by the NFL and they're incentivizing it essentially, which has kind of been the case a lot of places. But
universities are a big one, but in terms of potentially requiring vaccination.
Yeah. And we've seen that. We've seen that at a few schools already, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. To me,
now let me add one more aspect to it as we continue this. Wearing masks and being vaccinated have oddly become a political issue. Oh. If I see someone wearing a mask, I think I know which way they voted.
Yeah, and it's been the other way around too. I mean, it's, you're either a Trump supporter because you don't wear a mask, or you're, in the eyes of many, a liberal because you do. And
the vaccination rates, I think, are also sort of highly correlated with political leaning.
That so wouldn't surprise me
the
at all.
NFL's policy is impacting potentially, you know, it's different levels of treatment based on political ideology. It's, you know, are they going to require vaccination cards to enter the stadiums? It's, you know, it's about a pandemic, but because the pandemic has become so highly politicized, is the NFL business now going to become highly politicized with some fans and sort of the unvaccinated fans and the players receiving different treatment than the vaccinated? And I know a lot of people think that's fine. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people think that's really kind of a worrisome situation that you have to be injected to not have suffer some sort of penalty.
Right. So I think it comes down to, is there a penalty against the people that aren't injected, or is there a reward for people that are? And I think that it can get a little blurry there, and that's just a matter of perspective. You know, everyone's got their opinion on vaccinations and masks and all the rest, and you know, I'm not here for that discussion. But I do think it's an interesting time for these leagues that are trying to manage fans that are on both sides, because a league like the NFL is so large that they don't want to alienate their anti-masker fans or their anti-vaxxer fans. They also don't want to alienate those that are on the other side of things. And so it's got to be such a difficult time to run a league like this, because, you know, on the one hand, you can look at it and say, okay, well, if you don't want to offend these people, then just don't require it and don't have all these rules in place. But they don't do that, people, you know, on the other side of things are gonna be all upset about it, and they're gonna boycott.
They'll be offended by not offending.
Yeah, and they'll boycott and protest and all the rest. And so it puts these leagues in such a difficult position. I know a lot of businesses have faced this in this last year, and I'm glad I'm not the one navigating that for such a large audience, but it will be interesting to see how it plays out. And it could very well set the stage for the political leanings of these leagues and how they tend to handle their fans, which ones that they choose to offend, if they're going to offend any.
So the NFL, different policies for vaccinated versus unvaccinated, that's a tough one to navigate. It's a tough one to talk about because, again, it becomes political and that becomes kind of you're going to step on a landmine.
Yep.
The next story on my list is something that neither you or I is probably remotely capable of having a discussion about.
Great.
So let's jump in. Megan Rapinoe is now a brand ambassador for Victoria's Secret.
Yeah,
Victoria's Secret is retiring. They're, as they called it, no longer culturally relevant angels. Okay, so culture hits marketing. The, I don't know, bombshell Victoria's Secret angel is no longer culturally relevant. They are now hiring a bunch of folks, but Megan Rapinoe easily got the most press. She is, of course, an athlete, a star, I think retired soccer player, does not fit the stereotype of the previous Victoria's Secret spokesmodels. Now, as a marketer, this, you know, at first glance, this is a dramatic departure from what that brand has been, where the brand has always sort of been built around the word of sexy. And now it is a brand that is, I think, going to be built around the notion of accomplishment. Now, I intentionally say that with some kind of confusion in my voice, because it is a clothing, fashion, underwear, lingerie brand. Does that work? And so, Doug, like I said, this is a conversation that neither of us are really equipped to have. We are not in their target demographic. I find myself thinking, well, this seems crazy in terms of the marketing. But then I come back to something that Michael Jordan, I think, endorsed Hanes. You know, he did ads for Hanes.
He did do that.
A long time. And so, I don't know, man. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Hanes is definitely on a different kind of public image.
Maybe that's what Victoria's Secret wants now, though.
Yeah, man. I don't know. This is kind of out of my ballpark here. I do know some modeling friends that aren't super pumped about the direction things are going because of their careers and how they feel that they're being boxed out for the way they look all of a sudden. As far as the branding goes, it's very start. I mean, that's a very drastic move. That's a very drastic move. Clearly has its influences. I think they're trying to redefine what they already were. But with that said, it's like, does that sell? Well, I mean, time's going to tell, and it could, because the world's changing and what consumers prefer and how people view the world. I mean, a lot of this is just a response to a more liberal and a more, a different consumer base than what it used to be. And so part of me is like, maybe they've got some kind of information on the consumers and have realized that what they've been doing has been offensive or has been alienating or has made people feel bad about themselves or has been, and all that. And it's decided, let's take a completely opposite approach and adapt to this changing world. So, and I'm looking at this very objectively saying that, I'm not really delving into opinions if I were to have any on this subject.
I think that's fair to say, maybe they have information that we don't know about. And I think that's kind of a natural reaction of like, maybe this is what their market research says to do.
Yeah.
Here's the concern though. And again, this combination of, and again, all these things, because Megan Rapinoe is an athlete. She is also an advocate. So this is again, this confluence of sports, marketing, culture, politics, that I think for a lot of these brands, and we could go back to this earlier conversation about these leagues, that there's like this public relations heat that they're afraid of. Mm-hmm. And so maybe the core customer for Victoria's Secret is not interested in, look, these brands, the brands need to be for everyone. What percentage of the female population does Victoria's Secret, do they need to target? Maybe it's 20%, maybe it's 30%. A lot of the culture seems to suggest, or let's say the online, the Twitter kind of culture, seems to suggest everything needs to be appeal or not offend anyone. Mm-hmm. And so is that possible let's just imagine that Victoria's Secret was really on point for 25% of the market. Is adopting a brand strategy that is not going to offend this 100% of, it's not going to offend anyone, does that end up being damaging? My suspicion, and again, you can push back and say I'm not entitled to have it, my suspicion is that they are kind of grasping for relevance and this probably wasn't it. Okay, Doug, the last one, which is kind of interesting. Cristiano Ronaldo. Mm-hmm. So apparently brushed off Coke and wanted to drink water instead. And Coca-Cola had a market reaction where they lost $4 billion.
First off, I've always kind of wondered how valuable these like sponsorship / endorsements are. And I think that gives you a feel for, maybe we've been undervaluing like what these players are paid for their endorsements of certain products. And maybe that's telling for the coming NIL days of these college players and what they'll be worth, with their sponsorships or endorsements or whatnot. Second off, was he contractually obligated to not do what he did, essentially?
You know what? I don't know the answer to that. I wouldn't be surprised if there's some language in the contract that basically says, you don't mess with the sponsorship properties.
Yeah.
Right? But it might be something that he's never actually paid any attention to. Could be a deal that someone else, I don't even, not a soccer guy. I think does he play for like Portugal, perhaps? Plays for a European country. that his national organization might sign something that dictates how they're going to deal with sponsorships, and it may be basically irrelevant to him. Now, the thing that's interesting about this, though, is if you look at, let's just go with IG. That seems to be the thing where people want to pay attention to in terms of branding. Coca-Cola has 2.7 million Instagram followers on their account. You want to guess how many Ronaldo has, Doug?
Quite a bit more.
Well, want to even give a multiple, a ballpark.
All right, multiple. We're going to say, did you say, how many does Coca-Cola have?
2.7
million?
Yeah, brands don't.
That's awful. I'm going to say, this is why influencer marketing is so big. But Ronaldo, I don't know.
It's true, right? Coca-Cola inevitably has fewer than the Paul brothers.
Yeah, right? Inevitably. I'm going to say 20 times as much.
He has 300 million IG
followers. Okay, well, I was way off.
Okay, so and as far as I can tell, he has the largest Instagram account on the planet. Mm-hmm. So he's beyond the Ariana Grandes and the Selena Gomez's and sort of even the pop stars. And so in terms of cultural cachet, this is kind of an interesting thing because, right, Ronaldo is bigger than Coca-Cola, right? Ronaldo is, if we're going by Instagram followers, Ronaldo could be the biggest global star. whenever I'm teaching class, I'll tend to throw out some of these kind of pieces of data that, LeBron James has about 80 million IG followers, and the Los Angeles Lakers, which might be the biggest brand in sports, have about 14 or 15 right. million. It's a strange kind of power dynamic. But then you take the, sort of that LeBron James level of fame, and you with Ronaldo, you put it on a global level. And what is, and look, this has been a theme for a lot of what we've discussed over the last year in terms of the balance of power shifting towards players. But, wow, it's almost like these brands, in a way, need to do the deals with the players rather than the organizing bodies, because the players are where the power is. LeBron has the power. Ronaldo has the power. These leagues and tournaments, these are kind of platforms that have, they're kind of middlemen at this point.
Yeah. So remind me, how much money was on the line here with Ronaldo's?
Well, the market reaction was sort of Coca-Cola, what the stock market punished them for, was about $4 billion. Now, again, does the market overreact? Have they gained that back?
Yes.
I don't know, but it's just sort of an interesting take that you have a run in with an influencer, you take a hit.
Yeah. I just think it's amazing to me too. Side subject, sidebar conversation here. When the athletes endorse things like soft drinks, things that don't enhance performance for world-class athletes, the belief that these guys are, Michael Jordan and McDonald's.
Ballpark Franks too.
Ballpark Franks, yeah. It's like, I'd be shocked if he ate more than one of those a year. But yeah, it's funny to me that there was such a drastic reaction to Ronaldo. As if Coca-Cola is going to tank, as if Coca-Cola is going to tank and everyone's going to stop drinking it because of what Ronaldo did, when he likely doesn't drink it ever.
Right, but look, I can imagine that, if Coca-Cola goes to war with Ronaldo, Coca-Cola is the big loser in that.
Yeah.
So interesting times. Balance of power shifting. Last story, Doug, before we wrap up. The Supreme Court today basically took the side of college players. And I think that the suit was brought by former college players. And so one of the side things that's interesting about this is there's all this movement to get more benefits for college players. But the college players, the current players, are almost by definition without representation.
Yeah.
Sort of a small side note in all this. Now, this decision seems to be relatively narrow, that the NCAA doesn't have the ability to price fix and sort of set caps, universal caps, on educational expenses, which I guess might be, getting nice computers. And but I think the point to this decision was the NCAA probably doesn't have the right to regulate anything in terms of free market compensation for these players. And this is going down at the same time that NIL, name, image, and likeness rights, are about to kick in, really, in just the next few weeks.
Yeah, next few days, really. I mean, probably within a week. It feels like NIL might just be the beginning. Maybe these players will be legally, maybe the NCAA is going to be forced to allow these players to be compensated however they may be. It's not a free market, and it has been a multi-billion-dollar industry built on the backs of unpaid labor, essentially by these talented young men, many of whom come from backgrounds where they don't have a lot of resources, where they don't have a lot of money, and they're not being paid. And only a percentage of them are able to eventually get compensated for what they do. I know plenty of players that added quite a bit of value in my alma mater, who, because of injuries or any number of reasons, were not able to cash out on that in professional leagues. So it's, to me, it feels like this has been coming for a very long time, and it is just moving more rapidly, I guess, than we would have expected. With NIL, I'm incredibly interested to see how schools are allowed to help the players, because I know right now there's all these apps where players can essentially get on and find a match as far as brands that want to partner with them and kind of do business on their own. Are schools going to be brokering these kinds of deals? Are they allowed to do that? Are they going to essentially have their own agents for the players that are working out deals? Because it may seem like maybe the schools aren't incentivized to do that, but if you look at recruiting budgets for schools like Alabama, University of Georgia, these schools are spending a lot of money to have any amount of advantage. And it seems like, and we've discussed this in the years to come, being the school that can best help players benefit off of their own name, image, and likeness, best help players earn money, is going to be, what ends up winning championships, because you're going to attract the best players and you're going to attract more players. And so I think schools are very much incentivized to help these players as best they can. And I just don't know what's allowed. I don't know if anybody does.
No one
does. What can schools do to help the players? Right now, there's just these apps, but I haven't seen any staffs being formed of, like I said, like kind of brokers that are working back and forth between brands and players and working on with their schedules. And because it's going to take a player like Trevor Lawrence, for example, he's essentially, his DMs are going to, a player like that, and I'm just saying his DMs are going to blow up. He's not going to, as a college kid, he's going to have 1,000 DMs every day of people wanting to do partnerships. There is going to be a need for kind of a middleman and somebody to facilitate deals and to work and to pull things together for these kids and work with them. And it's like, is that going to be a kind of black market business, or is that going to be something that the universities are going to have staffs doing? I have no idea. I don't know where things are going, but it does look like the Supreme Court is going to rule in favor of players if today set any precedent for future legislation. And so it does seem like, maybe it's going to be a little bit more of a free market for these guys. Maybe even for schools, it'll be less of a behind the scenes kind of thing. They'll be able to openly help these players and do what's best for those individuals, and ultimately what's going to be best for those schools given the new landscape.
Well, I think I don't know a good answer to all of this at this point, because I think everyone's going to move in different directions. I think some schools have talked about providing guidance in terms of brand building. Your point about are they going to provide support staff is a really, really interesting one. How big should that support? Hey, look, here's my word, unintended consequences. Okay, the genie is out of the bottle, Pandora's box, whatever phrase you want to use. Something is coming and it's about to get interesting. Let's say Alabama or Georgia with the massive budgets, Texas, they build in support staff to help people with these branding, to help people with branding exercises. If you actually start to, you know, let's say having guys that are helping people create relationships, man, I see nothing but trouble ahead. So suddenly the relationship manager at Clemson is funneling an opportunity to the right cornerback rather than the left cornerback. And now the left cornerback is going to enter his name into the transfer portal. If the support services are given to the football team, what does that mean for the women's gymnastics team in terms of Title IX?
Right, right.
Do they have to have equal support staffs, even though there's far less coming in?
Money, yeah.
Are the schools entitled to a chunk of money from all this? I'm just going to leave it as one word of unintended consequences, but it's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, it's the Wild West. It's the Wild West right now.
As we wrap up, you want to, there's a lot going on in sports. It's kind of a great time. Anything we've missed this week?
Man, I feel like there's something. I don't know.
We've missed a lot. NHL playoffs, Euro 2020 soccer. Yeah.
It's just fun times, man. It's like the NBA, I think, is incredibly fun right now. And then it's like coming up because everything was delayed this year. There's like baseball season's going on and will be in full form. By the time basketball's finishing up, and soon after that, the Olympics start, and then football starts back up around that time with NFL preseason and college football cranking up. And it just feels like sports are back. America's back. I know, really there's been full capacity audiences at NBA games, and that hasn't even been discussed much. I mean, this, for the longest time we were talking about, you know, are there gonna be fans back, and is there gonna be, and we went from like 25% capacity to 50% capacity to 100 real, real quick. And it's like sports are back. And it's great to see. I hope things stay on the trajectory that they're on, because, I think it's a good thing for this country, to be honest. And I'm excited about these coming weeks. I'm also excited about Ted Lasso coming out next month. I had to throw that in there. But the reason the Atlanta Hawks are having so much success is because their new tagline has been Believe, which, of course, their marketing department or whatever, whoever came up with that, it was heavily influenced from the show Ted Lasso, which we will be discussing in a future episode.
Absolutely. Okay, we'll wrap it there. As always, much more at www.fandomanalytics.com. Thanks for listening.